Is your business stuck in one spot, struggling to grow? Our 8-week ProFit Business Accelerator at winninggym.com/grow has your back. Sign up now for easy wins. No more struggle, just straight growth. You've got this. Now let's head on back to the show.
You are listening to the Built to Grow podcast, delivering the knowledge in all things fitness business. We help gym owners win. Here are your hosts, Tim Lyons and Randy Engston.
All right. Welcome back to the Built to Grow podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lyons, in a special Zoom episode, joined as always by Randy Engston. What's up, buddy?
What are you doing, my guy?
All the way across town through the screen. We got Randy Engston, and joining us, a special guest today from Gym Lawyers. Is it LLP, I'm guessing? LLP?
E-L-L-C.
P-L-L-C. Matthew Becker joins us. How are you doing, sir?
I'm fantastic. How are you guys?
Yeah, we just saw you in Chicago. He's one of our platinum sponsors right there in the front row. As you got your ticket, you just walk right past Matthew Becker and his crew at Gym Lawyers. And I saw a big crowd around your booth a lot of times. People got a lot of questions. So we're going to get into this episode. We're going to talk about some horror stories. We're going to talk about some probably things you wish you were doing differently, because he's going to blow holes in basically everything we're all doing. We've already blown holes in five things before the call, so I'm sure there's going to be five more holes being blown into it. So let's real quick, how did you become the gym lawyer? Where did that start?
my wife and I like to guess I'm a real lawyer. So I started practicing in 2009, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was just your run-of-the-mill litigator. I was doing criminal defense, suing car dealerships, doing a very, very little bit of family law. And then 2013, I opened up my gym. It was a CrossFit affiliate, and pretty much did both. So I litigated during the day, and I coached class in the morning and the evening until about 2019. So I made it about 6 years as a dual, I guess, owner operator and litigator, whatever. And then decided that, or accepted the fact that litigating the law is just completely miserable. And I much preferred being at the gym around people who were like, I want to reach a goal. This is exciting.
Right.
So closed that practice down. COVID really helped, because I got all of my cases settled, and came out of COVID just barely still practicing, and then got it completely done. So I made it 1 year as just a business owner, or just a gym owner, and then got the idea planted that there were no legal profession or no professional services designed toward the legal aspect of owning a business and gym ownership. So, you guys do business consulting and mentorship and help gyms grow their businesses up. And you've got insurance companies that are directed toward gyms. You have John Briggs at your seminar. You have accounting that is directed toward gyms. There's loans and business banking and stuff directed toward gyms, but there was no legal. So just sort of was like,
I'll do it.
Rich. The idea. So the idea was planted in my brain and took a few iterations of what exactly this looks like. And that was 3 years ago. And now I've had to sell my gym because I have no time to run it. And I just talk to gym owners all day, every day about law.
About law. Wow. Fantastic. You know what's fun about law is when somebody else is going through it and you get to hear the story, not you.
Nothing is fun about law.
Yeah.
But I have a fun time with it.
Yeah, yeah, because you're getting paid and not on the other.
Yeah, I guess.
So let's talk some horror stories, or maybe just some like exposures that gym owners have and you see most typical that they're unaware of. Like, let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a theme that businesses should understand when they're thinking about the law, okay? And most of us are only familiar with the law once we need it. So, you know, I want to get a divorce. I need a divorce attorney. I get a car accident. I need a personal injury attorney. I get charged with a crime. So I need a criminal defense attorney, right? When we're in business, as business owners, we don't get that luxury. So 9 times out of 10, the issues that crop up because we were not in compliance with something back in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so that's like what it, if there's one thing that, you know, I really want gym owners to take away from listening to this, it's you're a business owner. You cannot sit around and wait for clients to come into your gym. You have to go out and be active about it. You cannot sit around and wait until you have a problem. You have to be proactive about it. And, you know, that's the horror stories that we get are the horror stories that arise because the gym owner either didn't know it was going to be a problem, didn't realize it was going to be a problem, or didn't think it would ever happen to them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are sort of like a big part of the conversation that we have at gym owners is like, you need to do X, Y, Z to prevent this from happening. So, I mean, horror stories galore.
So you got, I mean, yeah, you want to be protected. You want to set it up right from the beginning. Like, are we talking about liability waivers? Are we talking about contracts? Mm-hmm. Talking about insurance policies? Are we talking about like what? Let's get into some of that. Let's talk about some people getting hurt at a gym, because that's probably my it's probably my biggest fear. Right? We work with clients all day. There's risk of injury. It says it so, and there's even risk of death. It says it right here. You're signing that you agree that you've consulted with your doctor. You're physically fit to do this. You understand your risks, and even death is in that risk line, and you're okay with it. Sign here. How protected are we really?
All right. So we do get that sentiment. Let's talk liability waivers. We do get that sentiment at times that like, well, if I get sued, is my waiver really going to help me? So we kind of have to walk the gym owner down a path. So let's start at the beginning of the path. Let's assume you go with the tactic of, I don't have a waiver. I don't need a waiver. If I get sued, I'm screwed anyway. Well, okay, that's true. And if you get sued, so if you don't have a waiver, the client who gets injured is automatically going to go to an attorney. So we first want to have a waiver in play in hopes that that client looks and says, I hurt myself, but I did sign this legal document that says I could hurt myself. So is this really worth my time to go after? No, I'm not going to.
Okay.
There's going to be, go ahead, Tim.
Deterrent.
Yeah. So there's going to be a certain number of people who are automatically deterred because they signed something that looks like a legal document. And the more legal crap we can put in there and the more legal stuff we can make a look at, the more we can scare people and deter them from ever bringing anything. The second layer is that client who then hurt themselves said, I signed a waiver anyway, but these things don't hold up. I'm going to go to an attorney. They take it to an attorney. And the attorney looks at it and says, oh, this is a pretty extensive liability waiver. I'm not going to waste my time taking this case for free, because that's what personal injury attorneys do, to try to make money on the back end, because this thing also has, if it's a well-written waiver, what's called an indemnification clause, which means if I sue you, Tim, and I lose, guess what? I got to pay your attorney's fees. Mm. Okay. So, you know, that's sort of like deterrent number two is I have a waiver and it's a well-written waiver. It's longer than a page, and an attorney is going to look at that and go, yep, not going to touch it. Okay. Let's go one step further. Next further is that attorney still says, I still think there's some money to be had here. So here's your demand letter or the lawsuit that comes at you because my client got hurt in your gym. If you have no waiver, that's going to be an instant denial from your insurance company. So that $1 million per $2 million, you know, gross policy that you're paying $1,200, $1,500, $1,700 a year for just went out the window because you didn't do anything to protect yourself. Okay. And the insurance company is going to go, boom, you're done. So now this opens up the potential can of worms of, well, now you're stuck defending this lawsuit on your own. Average defense costs are $25,000. Average lawsuit for a gym is 3 years. Average settlement is $50,000. So we can look at right now, a gym owner with no liability coverage, no insurance coverage, is all but going to come out $75,000 out of their pocket over the next 3 years. Their LLC or their corporation probably isn't set up correctly. So an attorney is just going to be able to pierce right down through that and get right at the individual gym owner. Mm-hmm. So every gym owner thinking about this or listening to this and thinking, I'm not sure about all of this stuff. Your bank account, your house, all your assets likely exposed to something like this. Okay. So let's rewind back up here. We at least have a liability waiver and we can turn that over to the insurance company. And the insurance company goes, oh, okay, cool. We'll cover your claim. Gym owner goes on to fight another day. Insurance premiums are going to go up. They go on to fight another day.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Well, if it's sign the waiver and they get hurt and they got a lawyer, where does that agreement come in where they agreed that there's a risk here that I could get hurt? Why would the insurance company just pay the thing? Wouldn't they fight it?
Sometimes. Okay. The insurance company is going to do a cost benefit analysis of it and determine, is this worth just paying out? Is there a chance we're going to lose based on the injury? Based on the waiver is maybe not super clear, even though it's good enough that we'll cover it, says the insurance company. But there's also two different types of negligence. There's ordinary negligence and there's gross negligence. So ordinary negligence is just negligence that is ordinary to the type of businesses that we run. I come into your gym, Tim, and you say, go deadlift max effort, and I go and pick it up. I hurt my back, and I say, I only hurt my back because you told me to pick up the deadlift, so I sue you, okay? In a CrossFit gym, an attorney is going to come in and argue, or in any gym, that's ordinary stuff, okay? There's only so much a coach can watch them do. They took them through all of this introductory program. They built them up to 450 pounds. There's only so much they can do. It's ordinary that the client may have a little blip of concentration and boom, there goes his low back out. Okay. That's ordinary negligence, or at least an arguable ordinary negligence, not flip the script. I come into your gym and I say, went to the doctor yesterday and he says, I have a slipped disc in my back and I probably shouldn't deadlift today. And you say, well, come on, Matt, it's Matt's deadlift day. Come on. You can do this. You can do this. Just load it up, man. I'll watch your back. It'll stay flat. You ready? Squeeze those shoulder blades. You're good. 1, 2, 3, lift. And I pull it up and I snap my back. That's gross negligence.
Yeah.
Because you had information that you recklessly disregarded that led to me getting further injured. Nothing is going to cover you for gross negligence. So insurance companies are going to look at that line and they're going to say, is there an argument here that this could be gross negligence? Is there an argument here that this could be some sort of long-term permanent disfigurement? If so, we better get out of this thing. Because they can get real bad down the road. Okay.
Got it. Okay. Well, that sucks. Why would anybody want to open a gym? Or run a business, or run a business at all for that matter, right? Yeah. Well, I get it. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Ordinary or gross negligence. What about a situation where we got these AEDs on the wall?
Is it?
That have heart attacks, drop flat on your floor. You hear, you know, we've had to open that AED up once. We didn't have to apply it, but we were close. You hear about cases or stories or, you know, gym owner to gym owner where you try to save somebody's life and you get sued because of it versus letting them have a heart attack and, you know, letting them go, right? Like Where's the responsibility here at the personal trainer, gym owner level, staff level? I know we're all trained, CPR, AED trained.
Yep.
Where does the line get drawn where you could get sued for trying to actually help somebody save their life? Like where's that? What right. happens then?
Right. That's going to be on a state by state basis.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so there's going to be a couple different things that factor in here. One is, yeah, you got to be AED CPR certified. So if you're not, I don't know, it's like $150 or something like that. Go out and get it. because, again, we have that first line of defense. Some states are going to say you have to have an AED in your gym. And if you don't, and somebody goes down, you're going to be in trouble. And again, Tim, you probably never thought somebody was going to have a heart attack in your gym. I never thought somebody would have a heart attack in my gym. And it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was even, he was young. Wouldn't be, you know, it's not like the old guy who's grossly overweight that is wheezing when he walks in your gym. You're like, that guy's probably going to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
He was a young guy. He was crushing Murph and down you went. So it does happen. Now, the third layer to that is, you know, yes, you got a CPR AED certified. Yes, you have an AED in your gym. Yes, you used it. Now, does your state's Good Samaritan laws kick in? Okay. Does your state have any Good Samaritan laws? Which basically says, you know, are you then, like lifeguards get caught with this stuff all the time, okay? Or doctors get caught with this stuff all the time because they have a duty, a statutory duty to protect. And so if they don't do anything, then they could potentially be in trouble. If they do something, nothing will ever prevent you from being sued. That's not the name of the game. There's some name of the game of preventing you from being sued, but it's also, are you doing everything correctly so that despite the fact that you got sued, you can easily get out of that lawsuit? Because if you do all of these things correctly within your state law's compliance, and you try to initiate and put an AED on somebody and try to save their lives and they die and you get sued and you followed all of your state's laws, that case is going to go away super fast. Okay. Whereas if you didn't, it's not going away. So you know, it's similar. I'll tell gym owners, if you are reacting now in an effort to try to stop chargebacks, there's something down the line that you missed. Okay. If you're acting now in order to try to prevent somebody from bringing the lawsuit after they got hurt in your gym, there's something down the line that you missed in the process. And that's what we're trying to prepare gym owners for. And so, when that guy goes down at the end of Murph and has a heart attack, like, yes, even I was puckering, but I at least slept well that night because I knew, like, okay, cool, he's got a good waiver. My insurance company has confirmed my waiver. Like, we're okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to the hospital tomorrow. I'm going to check in on him so he didn't see my ass. We're okay.
Isn't that wild? No, I'm just saying, like, you hear about these stories where somebody's trying to help somebody and then they get roped into some long case for trying to do the right thing. And just because somebody's looking to get paid or something, there's always there's a lot of ulterior motives sometimes when it comes to these lawsuits. Anyways, we'll get off of that. Let's get into some of these contract agreements. And you were mentioning before, like, some states don't allow you to take paid in fulls or more than a year of paid in full. Like, the 2 years, that's a problem. What states are you referring to that can't take a paid in full? A couple.
Yeah, I don't have them all memorized, because there's about 48 out of 50 states that have some version of what's called a Health Club Act, right? So that's question number one. So let me, and as we get into this, let me just say, I may refer to it as a contract, and the gym owner listening is going to be like, we don't have contracts because our members are just month to month. It's still a contract. We enter into an agreement by which you pay me to deliver a service, that is legally a contract. Use whatever word you want. It's a contract. All right. So as we get into it, the first question is, does your state have a Health Club Act? I'll just talk about Florida. I'm pretty familiar with Florida's. I don't know. We have like pockets of clients all over, but Florida tends to be a big one. So the first question is, does Florida have a Health Club Act? Yes, it does. It's called something like the Health Studios Act or the Health Spa Act, something like that. Okay. Question number two is then, if it has that, does the law require the gym to register with the state? Yes, Florida does. So we proceed. New York does not. California doesn't. Pennsylvania and Maryland only require it if you're selling more than 3 months in advance. Okay, so there's little caveats throughout each one of the states that have one of these. But does it require you to register? Yes, it does. Okay, let's proceed on to the next question. If it requires, if they have a health club act, maybe it requires registration. Does it require a written membership agreement, contract, terms and conditions, call it whatever? Florida, let's continue down the road. Yes, it does. So it's going to say that if you are selling anything on any kind of auto recurring basis, which we all do, it has to be in writing. And there, you have to have certain terms within your writing, and you have to have very specific verbatim statutory language in your agreement. If you don't, the whole thing is void. So we then have to draft this so that it's compliant with the state laws. And then the next question is, do they then have to post what's called a surety bond? Okay, an S-U-R-E-T-Y bond. Okay. A surety bond is essentially a big monetary payment that you give to the state because the state has said we want to protect the consumers in our state. And in order to do that, you have to post the bond with the state that the Attorney General's office is going to hold on to, usually the Attorney General's office. And that way, if you suddenly close down and you've taken all of these prepayments, our citizens now have the ability to go to the state and say, hey, I paid $1,500 in advance for a year-long agreement with this gym. They closed down 8 months prior to that, or 8 months in. I want my money back, and you can get your money back from that bond. Okay? Now, the need to post that bond is going to depend on the type of membership that you're selling. All right? Continuing to Florida. If you sell anything in Florida that is auto-recurring in a schedule of less than 30 days, you do not have to post a bond. If you go over 30 days, if you're selling 3 months in advance, 6 months in advance, 12 months in advance, pay in fulls, you have to post a bond. Doesn't say it's illegal, just says there's additional hoops you have to jump through.
And the point there is if you close early before that term's fulfilled upon, there's recourse for the consumer. That's the point. Okay, got it. All right.
That's the primary point. And if you're caught and you don't do this, you know, you're not registered, you're not using proper membership agreements, which are now void, you're taking pay in fulls, but you're not, you haven't posted a bond. Most states will just have what's called a civil treble damages clause. So, you know, if your regular claim against me would be worth $2,000, well, now it's worth $6,000. Other states literally make it a criminal offense on the business owner. It can be like a misdemeanor in the third degree. If you just said, yeah, screw it. No, I'll never get caught. Okay. So we try to, again, just work with gym owners and be like, look, guys, this is the education. You are now not ignorant of the law. I can tell you it's going to be a lot cheaper to go through the process now. Even if you've been in business for 5 years, we can still fix the problem. It's a lot better if you go through the process now than it is if you just run the risk that you're never going to get caught.
Attention gym owners, are you ready to take your business to the next level? Join our exclusive Facebook group, ProFit Accelerator, and unlock the potential to scale your gym to $30,000 a month and beyond. In the ProFit Accelerator group, we're going to focus solely on helping gym owners just like you win. We offer regular training sessions and share our best proven strategies to boost your business. Join us now by searching for ProFit Accelerator on Facebook. Be part of a community that's all about success and growth, the ProFit Accelerator, where gym owners thrive. All right, now let's get back to the show.
Got it. And really, you would only get caught in that situation if you closed and somebody went to go get recourse and it didn't exist, right? Like there's no reason that would ever come up, maybe, unless somebody was just trying to go after you.
Sure. Randy, did you have, I want to gloss over your question.
You're good. Well, I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, obviously through conversation, you know, we've driven some of those points home, but when you're starting the business, it makes a lot of sense to refer to, you know, the law side. Same thing when you're you know, operating your business, it makes a lot of sense to have that, you know, in place so that you're protected throughout. What about in the event that you're looking to sell? How does some of that play into, you know, is you're protecting yourself as, you know, when you're looking to sell the business? How does that
you know, so I'm going to go with Tim first, and then I'll come back to Sally. Okay. So Tim, a couple different places that this can come up. One is if you start to make it, let's assume I come into your gym, I pay in full, and I want to get out of it, or you say, hey, there's no refunds. Okay. And they go, well, yeah, but I want my money back. And nowadays you can almost get away with a chargeback, which I have heard of certain credit card companies looking into compliance, state compliance with the gym, and realizing the gym isn't following their state's laws. So therefore the contract was null and void to begin with, issued a chargeback. Okay. But instead I decide I'm going to an attorney. And that attorney now looks into the gym and realizes, not only do you not have a written membership agreement, so you have to give me my refund back, but I'm about to open up a can of worms on you because I'm now going to make a claim to the government that you're not registered, and they're going to come knocking on your door. Okay. Certain states do track down gyms. So Virginia is infamous for this. If you open up a gym in Virginia and you do not register, I guarantee you at some point the government is coming knocking at your door. And they have very strict laws in play that if you're caught operating without being registered for, like, you start taking payments and you're past 30 days after opening, it's like a $200 per day penalty that they will come after you for. Texas is getting pretty bad about it. Florida is getting pretty bad about it. I think Maryland's also pretty bad about it, that they will track you down. So it's not always, again, like you were saying there in your question, it's not always like,
got it.
Well, only if I'm just going to close. We had this issue come up in California. This was one of the horror stories that, you know, we kind of were just really glossing over before we started hitting record, but, you know, a gym owner, starts, you know, sleeping with one of the coaches. It gets out to the members. Everybody starts leaving the gym. He realizes he's not going to make his bills. He closes the gym. He took a whole bunch of paid in fulls outside of California law. And now there were literally clients with $10,000 of paid in full private training sessions for a year that had paid this gym that there's no money back. And so, you know, it's not just because he was closing that this came up, but it's the fact now that he now has a whole bunch of individual lawsuits coming at him because he was not compliant with the law and just closed. And so it's not enough that, like, the state can now come after him, but, like, all these individuals are coming after him too. And they got all kinds of claims to put in their complaints because he wasn't compliant at all and just closed right down. So these situations pop up in, like, the dirtiest little ways.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Horror story number one. Okay.
Now, Randy, how does this stuff work with selling? So a lot of times, if we can talk to a gym owner in the process of getting, you know, like, most of them come to us and they're like, I've got a potential buyer. Can you help me get through the sale? 100%. Okay. We'll get an LOI and then, you know, whatever. I can walk down how we do that through our phases. But occasionally we get that gym owner that says, I'm looking to sell in the next, like, 6-8 months. What can we do now to make sure that I can sell in the future? Certain states do have in their Health Club Act language that says you cannot assign or transfer the payment information of your client to a buyer of your gym unless you have written permission to do so from the client. So if I'm a savvy buyer, I'm going to come in and I'm going to look at the gym's membership agreement. One, I want to know, are these people actually on any kind of written agreement that says, once I buy the gym, we can continue auto recurring payments? Okay. And two, does the gym owner actually have the ability? And when we draft a membership agreement for a gym, we have an entire section that says, I, the member, give the gym permission to assign or sell my personal information to a potential buyer of the gym. Because if not, Yeah. I can go in, I can close on a purchase of a day of a gym today, and tomorrow all the members could leave and I'm starting from scratch. Now, there's nothing that really is going to prevent that from happening, period. But again, we're trying to set things up to eliminate this stuff from happening, to prevent it as much as possible from happening. Now, I can go down the route for, you know, LLC setups and waivers as well. But there's a lot we can do, not just from a business valuation, but from a liability valuation that is then going to impact the gym's value when that gym owner goes to get ready to sell, because we've set it up like a real business so that there's not a whole bunch of legal red flags that a buyer is now going to look at and come in and start picking apart.
Smart.
Yeah, smart.
No doubt. I mean, that whole clause about not being able to allow the new buyer to bill against the card on file, that's, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you don't know that that's there, I mean, if you're a savvy buyer, that might, I guess if I'm a savvy buyer and I'm going into a situation where that clause isn't in there, I mean, I would devalue that purchase quite a bit.
100%.
Yeah. So as an owner that you're trying to sell, you better protect yourself. So, I mean, all these things, nobody teaches you this stuff. And so that's why we have these experts coming on like yourself and just teach this crowd, our gym owner listener, you know, group. I mean, good Lord, there's so many things that you're just trying to help clients. You're just trying to make a couple bucks and support your family. And you got all these things to worry about. And it's like, man, nobody tells you this stuff when you're opening a business. So appreciate you sharing this stuff. All right. So let's go into, we keep talking chargebacks. So there's got to be something in these, you know, and in my experience, with chargebacks, they come every so often. It's usually somebody that disappears, that doesn't want to cancel in person or go through the real process that's written out and lined out for them. So they just charge back and say, hey, I canceled, and there's no real proof of it. And that's usually how these happen. Or I had a verbal conversation that I wasn't coming back, or no record of it, right? So we get these chargebacks that kind of sporadically happen. And, you know, typically we try to reach out to the member first, like, hey, what's going on? You know, and of course they don't answer, because that's the whole point of the chargeback. They don't want to talk to you in the first place. So they go and do it through their credit card processing, you know. And in my past experience, the consumer always won. There's no, like, the gym always loses. It's always one-sided. And, you know, you win one chargeback, the code changes, and then they resubmit it for another code. And it's like you just go down this path and you end up giving up, because there's always this one thing that usually throws off, you know, the owner's like, you know, hey, if you fight this and we win, you owe us another fee on top of that says, hey, for the wasting our time. However, when I finally got down to it, I was talking to the merchant processors and I'm like, why aren't we winning these? Like, they signed this agreement, it's clear as day. They're not following the process. What is the thing? Why are they winning? Like, I mean, I'm not here to like win or lose. I just like, look, don't you side with us ever as a business?
Right.
And it came down to one word, and it was installments. So the agreement had to say that the total agreement was X and it was being paid in installments of this amount and this frequency. The word auto bill needed to come off of that. Because in the prior, it was like, we're just going to auto bill you every 30 days for X amount, and this is your term. But when we use the word installments, we started winning. So like, what's the scoop with that, man? Like, where are you at with that?
Yeah. And the difficulty there is no gym owner wants to put a total on the contract, because that assumes that there's going to be an end date at some point to this agreement, that member is going to hit an end date. And so that starts to create, you know, that's just a conversation that we have to have with the gym owner that most gym owners don't want, because they don't want to put a limit on this. They want it to be open-ended. And so the first question that the bank is going to ask, first off, if it's an ACH transaction, I know everybody loves ACH because you eliminate the credit card fees. You will never beat a chargeback. You don't even get a chance. in ACH, because banks are super paranoid about people going into an account and grabbing out money, that the hint, the slightest hint of fraud, that bank's going to shut it down.
Yep.
So if you want a reason not to do ACHs, you at least get a fighting chance on a chargeback with a credit card or a debit card. So the next question is, the bank is going to say, was this authorized? And when we have just continually auto-recurring payments, even if we put additional authorization language within the agreement, we run into this a lot of times with like cancellation policies. Well, I have a 30-day cancellation policy, and if one of your payments falls within that 30-day window, I'm going to take that final payment. Well, that's a punishment payment. Like, let's be real. Like, you're not, that's not doing it. All the gym owner is doing is guaranteeing that they're going to get one more $175 payment out of this client. Maybe the gym owner is nice enough to say you can continue to come, but if the client doesn't want to come anymore, all you're doing is punishing that client for quitting. And the credit card companies know this. And we all do it. I did it for 11 years in my gym. But, you know, if you get a chargeback on it, you got to understand you're probably not going to win that, because the individual is easily going to be able to say to the credit card company, I didn't authorize that charge. I canceled my membership. We build in some language in membership agreements that we write that says things like, I understand I'm going to see a final payment and I authorize the gym to take this payment. That gives the gym a little bit of extra evidence, a little bit of extra fighting power, but it's never a guarantee. And so what you're talking about, Tim, is what credit card companies prefer to see, which is, this is a one-year agreement. It's $100 a month. It's a $1,200 a month. I'm putting that in the contract. And we're going to take installment payments of $100 every month. It's the same thing. Like, if you pull out your, if you finance your car, right, and you pull out your finance agreement, you got those like four or five boxes across the top that says, here's the total price. Here's the interest rates, here's the number of payments, here's the total payment, like your monthly payment, here's the total amount you're going to pay for your vehicle. That's what the banks want to see. But that requires the gym owner to put that limitation on there.
Interesting.
So going back to that last cancellation payment, when I was first opening and coming up in my gym, I was, under the tutelage of ABC Financial, which was a big box service provider, like merchant processor. They always want us to take the first and the last payment up front for that exact reason right there.
Yep.
We stopped.
And I have talked to gym owners who still do that.
Okay. Yep. First and last month, right up front. So when they do cancel, that last payment is their last payment. We've already collected your final last payment. So that 30 days, you got 30 more days with us, type of thing. Interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought about it until right now, but like, we stopped doing that years ago. But yeah, if we do get a chargeback, it might, I guess if 50% of the time it is on that last payment. Well, I canceled on this date and they billed me on this date, even though it's within that 30-day cancellation window.
There's two primary, I'm sorry, Tim, I didn't need to interrupt.
No, go ahead, man.
Actually, there's two primary reasons that gyms see chargebacks. One is this cancellation issue. I really think we're going to start to see a trend of gyms who are going to eliminate that 30-day notice or the 15-day notice, because they're going to understand that until there's some sort of regulation or legislation that goes in that tries to prevent these chargebacks, it's just not worth the headache. The second reason is, you've got auto-recurring payments to a member who is not coming to the gym. And they come to the gym for 3 months, or they don't come to the gym for 3 months, but you're auto-billing $175 for 3 months. They then realize it, like, it's all of a sudden one day their light bulb clicks on and they go, oh, well, I wasn't using that, chargeback. Okay. That's why I say, if you're getting to the point where you're calling me and saying, how do I fight this chargeback? We've missed buffers. You as the gym owner should be regularly following up with your members, regularly going through your agreements with them, talking to them, sitting down every 90 days or whatever and saying, does this membership still serve you? Do we need to move you to a different membership? Do we need to raise you up to more hybrid? Do we need to reduce you down more 3 days a week? And if that client is getting to the point where they're not coming for months on end and you're still charging them. We've lost something about keeping in contact with that member that really can move to prevent that net chargeback.
That's a delivery, not a financing issue.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to ask you, do you recommend if you don't see a client in 3 months to cancel their membership?
I'm not going to, I did that. You know, I never canceled a membership in my gym just because they weren't coming. But then at the same time, if somebody would have issued a chargeback on those, I mean, perhaps I'm just a little bit too logical in that frame, but I'm going to be pissed about it. I'm going to be like, well, they weren't really coming. I gave up reaching out to them like 2.5 months ago and I just kept taking their money. So can I really blame them for asking? I mean, chargebacks piss me off even when they're not mine. Like a chargeback, when a gym owner calls, they're like, I got a chargeback.
It's typically most of the time is because the, I'm going to take the gym owner side here, is that the client doesn't want to deal with the headache of going in and trying to get saved, right? We were trying to save it, right? They don't want to deal with it. So they just like, I'll call this credit card. And you can do it right online. You don't have to call anybody. You click a button on your Amex app and it's charged back. And now it's a 3-week process for the gym and they got to provide all this. So, you know, it's a mess. And it's very well-added, but it protects the consumer. I get it.
I can only imagine like big box gyms number chargebacks.
Oh,
like, I agree. A training gym, like because for that same reason, right? Like it's almost like you almost don't have a personal relationship with anybody in the business, right? Like I think of me walking in, I'm like, I avoid the staff beyond checking in because I don't, like, I'm there to rent equipment, you know? So like the lack of personal relationship, I could see people going that route real easily.
And I had a client, and I think, I forget what state, but somewhere that was very, very vacation heavy. And he had an all access gym. So it wasn't a lot of money to go in for a month, let alone like for people coming in for a week or two when they're in town. And he told me we were trying to figure out how to prevent chargebacks in this instance, because people would come in from out of town, especially out of country. They would pay for a week. They would do the drop in, they would use the gym, and then they would get home and issue a chargeback. And they would authorize them. And this was happening over and over and over again because there's no personal relationship with these people. And, you know, to answer, sort of address that concern, Tim, would I ever tell a gym owner not to take a final payment or something like that? I think there's differences in advice that I would give trying to prevent legal issues versus what you guys would give for trying to help somebody make money versus what an accountant would say about like trying to avoid taxes. So it's just looking through it through the legal lens. I'm going to look at something a little bit different than what you guys are. And that's fine. You know, that's why we're all professionals in our own right. And that's why I say, like, don't take legal advice from your accountant. Don't take business advice from me. Right. It's like, just stay in my lane. In my opinion, I'll give it to you, but
you know
it's from a legal perspective.
I was curious because, you know, obviously there's some moral dilemma there. I've got a client that's been with us for 12 years. I've never seen her in the last 10 years. She pays us religiously. She calls us to update her card on file. I don't.
Oh, really?
She knows she has it. She knows she's being billed. She just doesn't come in. And I think at some point it's like, makes her feel good that she has a membership she could use if she wanted. It's very interesting, the psychology around that. I mean, that's the whole key tag on your keychain thing for the low price model. It's like a, hey, I got a membership. I'm doing my job, right? Here's one right here.
Yeah.
I'm doing my job by having this, even though you never go to the gym, but there's something psychological there that says, oh, I have a gym membership. So it's just interesting. You know, everybody's a little different, but yeah, I mean, obviously you want to keep your clients coming into the gym. You're not really serving them if you're not training them or you're not, you know, but this is a business. They did sign up. They are adults. They know what they signed. There's no question about that. You know, especially at a high ticket, like with most of the gyms we work with, there's no question you signed up for $500 a month membership. You didn't accidentally sign up for that.
Hey there, gym owners. Is your business standing strong, making at least $30,000 or more a month? And you're seeking the next challenge, like what's the next step in your journey? Well, Look no further than the Iron Circle. Our elite growth community is the place for gym owners just like you who are not satisfied with the status quo. We'll show you how to take your business from good to great and from a strong gym into a powerful fitness legacy. Head on over to our website and apply to join the Iron Circle at ironcircle.net and start your journey to the next level today. All right, we'll see you inside the show. Bye.
I just wish most members would just have that conversation, you know, because it's usually the ones that charge back are the ones that just disappear. Now, that guy that had that vacation model where it was a open access, those people are stealing. Those are those people.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing it on purpose, right? They go and use it for a week and they come back and they charge back. Were you able to fix that guy's problem or no? Is that still unfixable?
We adjusted a little bit in his membership agreement in order to try to, again, like, make it more like these were authorized and like they knew everything that they were paying. But at the end of the day, like, you know, the other thing I was going to say to you, Tim, was, you know, there's always a cost benefit analysis on this as well. If it's $175 a month, if it's $50 a month for access, right? How much of a headache do am I really going to put in over that money? I don't want to lose money by no means. I'm not saying like walk away from it, but at the same time, like, how much of a pain in the ass? What is your effective hourly rate?
$50 for the bill, and you're getting banged another $25 for the chargeback from the credit card company. Mm-hmm. So you're losing $25 for letting this person use your gym for a month. Like,
that eventually adds up.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, when we're talking more high ticket, and, you know, you got your $500, your $750, your $1,000 a month clients, and those guys do a chargeback, we might be getting into that territory now where, you know, maybe we do want to start suing our ex members who are doing this crap to us.
You just use the word sue like it's like, because it's no big deal to him. It's like, like bench pressing 485. It's no big deal.
Whatever. You sue the bar every day.
Yeah, it's true though. I mean, like it's funny. Like you said, the lens that you look through instant, like that's just going to work for him. To us, it's like everybody's business owner's fear. Like, God forbid, like a lawsuit. 3 years of my life's tied up now, right? So,
right.
Yeah, that's wild. But I mean, could you imagine if that got out to your community, gym owners?
I know it. And there's a gym owner in the cheerleading realm. And so I entered into this discussion. We do, you know, cheerleading and gymnastics and part, you know, all kinds of different industries. And I got into this discussion once at a conference similar to yours that was directed toward cheerleading industry. And I said, you guys could, I mean, technically speaking, you could sue your clients. And they all said, I don't want that reputation. And this one gym owner stood up and she said, screw the reputation. I sue my clients all the time. And people know you don't F with me. With my membership agreements.
Okay.
And that's a different way of looking at it.
I mean, that would be the only way of looking at it. Like, if you're going to make the decision to sue your clients, you better have to believe them.
Let's go off track a little bit here and let's get into, I think we've discussed this in the past, either in person at the event or on the phone, but trainers. Coaches who are leaving your gym and soliciting and kind of like taking your clients. Now, this has happened to 15 years in business. It's going to happen, right? Like the trainers get these relationships with the clients and all this stuff. Now, the very first time it happened to me, it was like a gut punch, right? Like, oh my gosh, this is really happening right now. Where I got this coach, I have her on camera after she didn't show up for a shift and all the clients knew about it and they were at some other garage gym training, unbeknownst to me. She comes back in that evening. I have it on camera. She goes in into my office and steals the client binder with all the contact information and she leaves, right? She stole it. I have it on camera. Police were involved. It was a whole thing, but like, that was an easy one. She stole the thing that like the holy grail of all of our contact information. That was even before like a lot of CRM stuff was going on back in the day. This was in 2010, 2011. But this is the dirty little undersoul of this industry, the underbelly of the training fitness industry, is gym owners spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars marketing, acquiring clients, putting them into our system, using their gym, and we allow the coaches through pay, through employment, they're being paid to train and build a relationship with the clientele. Client, now, I don't blame the clients at all for this, but what happens a lot of times is that the results that the clients feel they're getting is as a result of this actual coach doing that job. Okay. So eventually the coach leaves and they just start, maybe the clients are calling the coach or maybe it's the vice versa, but now you got this dispute or you got this exodus going out of your gym. They're leaving to go train with another coach or that coach at another gym or in their garage or wherever. Where's the recourse for the owners and the business owners in this whole scenario?
Yeah. I'm just going to make the assumption they're all employees.
Yes.
Because we enter into some really gray areas when we're talking about independent contractors. And I'm not going down those. We can go in those weeds if you want to, but let's hang out with employees. All right. So the first question is, does the gym owner have any kind of an employment agreement with their staff? And it says there's three levels of documentation that gyms should have anytime we have employees. The top level is the employment agreement. This is the expectations and conditions that need to be met in order to gain and or maintain employment. So we're going to say things like your compensation, your job title, what certifications you have to have in order to gain employment, whether or not you have to be CPR, AED. Certified. Do you get any benefits? Do you get paid time off? Okay. This is all in kind of an agreement. And also our three restrictive covenants, which are non-competes, non-solicitations, and protection of confidential information. Okay. Non-competes, I'll put them in there if you want me to, but we'll just get them out. Okay.
I don't think anybody's worried about a non-compete, honestly.
Nobody's going to worry. Yeah. And especially in this industry.
About non-compete. You're allowed to go work wherever you want. It could be across the street.
Go work wherever you want.
That's what we're not worried about. Okay. We're not worried about that one.
So then we worry about the non-solicitation, which is what you're referencing, and the protection of confidential information. So first, we have to say in the non-solicitation that legally binding and an agreement, they cannot do anything to actively solicit the client. Then, and the protection of confidential information, we define confidential information in part as client information. So if it's discovered, and I'll get to this part in a second, but if it's discovered that the coach who left took the client's phone number with them, called up that client and said, screw Tim's gym, come to my new gym, they've just violated two sections of your employment agreement. They stole confidential information. And they use that confidential information to directly solicit a client away from your gym. Okay. The second level is your employee handbook. The third level is your standard operating procedures. I said three and they only talked about one.
Okay.
But the issue with a non-solicitation is it is incredibly difficult to prove. You were right in like your situation. That is like wonderful. Okay. Yeah. Nobody else is going to get that gold coming through on a non-solicitation. Non-compete, super easy to prove, super hard to enforce. I know you went to the gym down the road. I know you went to a competitor. You're now competing with me. And I've proven it. I just can't enforce it because nobody likes non-competes. The other side, a non-solicitation is really hard to prove, but easier to enforce because you have to be able to demonstrate that the ex-employee somehow actively solicited your client. That's difficult because if I go and I work at another gym and everybody I coached came with me, I go ahead and prove I said something. Maybe they just really liked me. Mm-hmm. Okay. I had this fear for quite a while when I was a gym owner because I had a primary head coach and she taught the majority of classes every day. People freaking loved her. And I would bend over backwards to keep her at my gym. Of this fear that if she ever left, even if they don't follow her somewhere else, they're just going to quit the gym because she was the face of these classes. And so you have to be able to demonstrate that the coach, now, if the, like I said, if you can show that I went and started working in another gym and I shot a whole bunch of emails out to clients and said, hey, come to my new gym. I'll give you 10% off your first month if you leave Tim's gym, and you can get a hold of that. That's great. That's really easy to enforce. Okay. The other, there's still that cost benefit analysis in this as well, of we then have to be able to demonstrate what is the monetary loss. And this is where we start to get into legal speculation about damages in gym ownership. So I leave your gym and 10 people come with me. Let's just say they're all paying $170. Let's go $200 a month. They're all paying $200 a month. I leave. These 10 come with me. That's allegedly an immediate loss of you for $2,000. And let's assume you can demonstrate that I solicited them away from the gym. Well, now the question is it worth your time and money to pursue $2,000? And you're going to say, well, it's worth a lot more than that. That's speculative because we don't know how long those people are going to continue to be gym members. So now, hopefully, the gym's been tracking things like length of engagement, average revenue per member, and all these things so that we can at least put dollars and cents out there to try to make this lawsuit presumably look big enough that it's worth an attorney's time who's going to say, well, I'm probably going to be paid some contingency of like 33 1/3% on this. So I'm not suing somebody for $2,000. Okay, it's not worth my effective hourly rate. Now, if you come to me with a $10,000 lawsuit, sure, I'll sue somebody for $3,333. Okay, that's a little bit more. So there's a lot of factors that come into play here that, yeah, we want these things in our agreement as a deterrent, as a conversation starter, as the ability to now go to that employee and say, look, dude, you're going to leave. That's fine. But shut your damn mouth. Because if I find out that you're violating my agreement, because you're soliciting our clients directly and you breached our confidentiality, I will come after you. And you can kind of put the fear of God in them. If you don't have that agreement, you don't even get to start that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. Once again, cost benefit analysis, is it worth your time? Because at the end of the day, yeah, you can nail that coach and maybe get some type of judgment or something, but the clients aren't coming back anyway. So it's like, I mean, you just got to outsell the product. Like it's, you know, again, here we are like painting horror stories for gym owners here because, you know, it's kind of funny. I chuckle when a coach wants to open a gym because we interview coaches all the time. And like, that's always the path. I want to open a gym, right? If they heard all the stories that they just listened to this podcast for three episodes, you'd change your mind real fast, especially when we got conversations like this. Yeah, there's a lot to get into here. I mean, we can go on for another 2 hours. Is there anything you want to make sure that we hit here, Matthew, so we make sure that the listeners can hear it?
You know, I don't think so. I think we've played the theme throughout. You know, just again, you need to prepare for these things, not wait for there to be a problem. If you call me up and you say somebody's leaving my gym, I need to prevent them from taking my clients, and I say, show me your members or your employment agreement that says they can't solicit your clients. You go, I don't have one.
I can't
do anything. So,
just a good question. Off the last thing that you were saying, you mentioned like showing damage, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much? Because like in that situation, let's say somebody did leave and let's say that they had a big impact on your gym. With our clientele, you know, a lot of the gyms that we work with, you know, a training studio might have 100 to 200 members.
Mm-hmm.
If a coach leaves, I mean, they could easily impact 25, 30 members, right? Mm-hmm. If that were the case and serious revenue did change, if you had good data on the business, how does that actually factor into a lawsuit? Do the agreements that are in place, let's say you had annual agreements and we're 6 months into most of them or something. Yep. Like, and it does, is that where the potential damages is going to reflect, or is it typically done a lot shorter, right? Like, you know, if you have 6 months on the agreement, are they going to look at that and consider that valid? You know, is there validity in the 6 months of potential revenue, or are they going to say, oh, the coach left, here's a month worth because who knew if they were going to be here in six, type of thing?
Yep.
Like, how does that data actually factor into you know, the actuality of it when it comes to light.
So again, let's first look, let's go all the way back to the beginning of this conversation. Do you have a written membership agreement that demonstrates that somebody is, unless they cancel for all intents and purposes, on the hook to pay and has authorized the gym to take payment? Mm-hmm. Is your gym registered? Do you have a written membership agreement? Are you compliant with all of your state laws? Because you better not go starting to make claims about loss of revenue, you know, if your house isn't in order.
Okay? Last house.
That's right. <Yep. laughs> So that goes back to like, why do we worry about all this stuff? Because this stuff pops up, and if it's not ready to go, it's not ready to go. But then to answer your question, the law is not in place in order to, you know, make somebody a millionaire based on something that happened. The law is in place in order to repair or replace a damage that has happened to you. So any defense attorney is going to come in a lawsuit like this is instantly just going to start to yell on speculation, because we can't prove what's going to happen in the future. We can only demonstrate what my loss was and then demand compensation for that loss. You follow me? So while there's no bright line rule to that, Randy, the answer to your question is the more data we have, the less speculation the damages look. Okay. If I have a membership agreement that is a 12-month long agreement and renews, you know, every 12, like not auto renew, but we got to sit down with members. Remember, Jim said, you can't have auto renew in there. But if we have a 12-year term on my membership agreement, forcing me to sit down with that member at the end of every 12 years and renew it, or I'm sorry, 12 months, and then renew it, right? And we have the monthly installments written out, then that's one data point that we can point to and say, well, I got 2 months in and that coach directly solicited my agreement for my client. I technically had a legally binding contract for an additional 8 months. That brings that speculation down a little bit. My length of engagement on a member is 21 months. My effective or my average revenue per member is $500 a month. So by average, that client is worth whatever the hell. $500 times 21 is okay. Quick math. That's why I'm not an accountant. And so that can also help to bring that speculation down a little extra point. Okay, so there's no like have XYZ and it takes away the speculation. But what we can do through the practices that we help gym owners put in place and the practices that you guys help gym owners put in place, so we can set the gym owner up in all these situations where we're talking about damages to try to remove some of that speculation.
Exciting chance. Well, let's hope it just never happens to anybody listening, but unfortunately, it's very, very common. It's just too common in the industry. So listen, yeah, Matthew, I'm telling you. So, I mean, so if somebody wanted to kind of engage and work with you to maybe take a look at their policies and contracts and maybe do like a full-blown audit, do you do audits like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, we do. We have a couple of different, we do auditing services. We do monthly compliance services. We do one-off services. What we don't do is hourly. I do nothing hourly.
Okay, it's
probably everything is down on a flat rate, so the gym owner knows exactly what it's going to cost them.
Oh, that's fair.
You hear me? What?
Is there a contract? Do I have to sign a contract?
How many installments is it?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, like one.
Got it. So you do these audits, you do projects. What is that? How do they get a hold of you?
The easiest way is just go to gymlawyers.com. There's I hate to just push people off to the website, but honestly, there's calls to action everywhere. If you submit a call to action, you'll automatically be prompted to schedule 45 minutes with me. It's a free discovery call. I'll do a legal audit on you from the point of your entity creation to where you are today and every hole that you've missed in between. My cell phone's on the website. My email address is on the website. I'm not going to hide from you. So just if you want to talk to me, go pick one of the various ways to talk to me.
Fantastic.
Probably I'm just going to schedule you for a 45-minute consultation anyway, but you know, you're just reach out.
Okay, so head over to gymlawyers.com, guys. We'll put the link in the show notes. So if you're driving, you don't have to write this down. It's easy to remember anyway. You got a nice vanity URL. That's what that's called, vanity URL. So Well done on that, Matthew. Thanks for joining us again. This is your second show with us, so you know, thanks for hanging out and kind of painting the doom and gloom for everybody. So, but here's the deal, Jim Motors. Go get this stuff fixed. You do want to do it now before you need it. I mean, you'll be glad if this ever happens. Again, it's like an insurance policy. Hope you never have to engage in it, but you better have one in place if you need it. Right. Yep. So, thanks for joining us and kind of sharing some war stories. It's always fun to jam with you.
Of course.
And thanks for, awesome. All right, guys. Well, that's it for this episode. Until next time, keep changing lives. We'll see you on the next show. Take care. Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Built to Grow podcast. If you want more help growing your business, join our free Facebook group, Profit Accelerator, helping training gyms grow to $30,000 a month and beyond. We'd love to see you there. Go check out the show notes for the link and keep building something great. And we'll see you in the next episode.